I call the accused, the minister Tungata Zebiwe, to the stand. That was a risky move on Mr. Petal's part. Even as a layman, Craig could see that Abel Corry had shown himself to be a hardy scrapper. Joseph Petal began by establishing Tungata's position in the community, his services to the revolution, his frugal lifestyle. "Do you own any fixed property?" "I own a house in Harare." "Will you tell the court how much you paid for it?"
$14,000.
"That is not a great deal to pay for a house, is it?"
"It is not a great deal of a house," Tungata's reply was deadpan, and even the judge smiled.
"A motor car?"
"I have a ministerial vehicle at my disposal."
"Foreign bank accounts?"
"None."
"Wives?"
"None."
He glanced in the direction of Sarah Nyoni, who sat in the back row of the gallery.
"Yet,"
he finished.
"Common law wives, other women?" "My elderly aunt lives in my home. She supervises my household."
"Coming now to the night in question, can you tell the court why you were on the Karoi Road?"
"I was on my way to Tuti Mission Station."
"For what reason?"
"To visit Miss Nyoni and to speak to her father on a personal matter."
"Your visit had been arranged?"
"Yes, in a telephone conversation with Miss Nyoni."
"You had visited her before on more than one occasion?"
"That is so."
"What accommodation did you use on those occasions?"
"There was a thatched indlu set aside for my use."
"A hut? With a sleeping mat and open fire?"
"Yes."
"You did not find such lodgings beneath you?"
"No, on the contrary, I enjoy the opportunity of returning to the traditional ways of my people."
"Did anyone share these lodgings with you?"
"My driver and my bodyguards."
"Miss Nyoni, did she visit you in these lodgings?"
"That would have been contrary to our custom and tribal law."
The prosecutor used the word isifebi. What do you make of that?"
"He might aptly apply that word to women of his acquaintance. I know nobody whom it might fit."
Again the judge smiled, and the prosecutor's assistant nudged Abel Corry playfully. "Now, Mr. Minister, was anybody else aware of your intention of visiting Tuti Mission?"
"I made no secret of my intention. I wrote it down in my desk diary."
"Do you have that diary?"
"No. I requested my secretary to hand it over to the defence. It is, however, missing from my desk."
"I see. When you ordered your chauffeur to prepare the car, did you inform him of your destination?"
"I did."
"He says you did not."
"Then his memory is at fault, or has been affected," Tungata shrugged.
"Very well. Now, on the night that you were driving on the road between Karoi and Tuti Mission, did you encounter any other vehicle?"
"Yes. There was a truck parked in darkness off the road, but facing in our direction."
"Will you tell the court what transpired then?"
"The truck driver switched on his lights, then flicked them 3 times. At the same time, he drove forward into the road."
"In such a way as to force your car to halt?"
"That is correct."
"What did you do then?"
"I said to my driver, 'Pull over, but be careful. This could be an ambush.'"
"You were not expecting to meet the truck then?"
"I was not."
"Did you say, 'There it is, pull over'?"
"I did not."
"What did you mean by the words, 'This could be an ambush'?"
"Recently many vehicles have been attacked by armed bandits, Shufta, especially on lonely roads at night."
"So what were your feelings?"
"I was anticipating trouble."
"And what happened then?"
2 of my bodyguards left the Mercedes and went to speak to the driver of the truck."
"From where you were seated in the Mercedes, could you see the truck driver?"
"Yes. He was a complete stranger to me. I had never seen him before."
"What was your reaction to this?"
"I was by this time extremely wary."
"Then what happened?"
"Suddenly there were other headlights on the road behind us, a voice on a bullhorn ordering my men to surrender and throw down their arms. My Mercedes was surrounded by armed men, and I was forcibly dragged from it."
"Did you recognize any of these men?"
"Yes. When I was pulled from the Mercedes, I recognized General Fungabera."
"Did this allay your suspicions?"
On the contrary, I was now convinced that I was in danger of my life.
Why was that, Mr. Minister?
General Fungabera commands a brigade which is notorious for its ruthless acts against prominent Matabele.
I object, Your Lordship.
The 3rd Brigade is a unit of the regular army of the state, and General Fungabera a well-known and respected officer,
Abel Corrie cried. The prosecution is totally justified in its objection. The judge was suddenly trembling with anger. I cannot allow the accused to use this courtroom to attack a prominent soldier and his gallant men. I cannot allow the accused to stand before me and disseminate tribal hatreds and prejudices. Be warned. I will not hesitate to find you guilty of gross contempt if you continue in this vein. Joseph Petal took fully 30 seconds to let his witness recover from this tirade.
You say you felt that your life was in danger?
Yes, said Tungata quietly.
You were strung up and on edge?
Yes. Did you see the soldiers unloading ivory and furs from the truck?
I did. What was your reaction?
I believed that these would somehow, I was not certain how, but I believed that they would incriminate me and be used as an excuse to kill me.
I object, Your Lordship, Abel Corrie called out. I will not warn the accused again,
Mr. Justice Domashawa promised threateningly.
What happened then? Miss J left the vehicle in which she was travelling, and she came near me. The soldiers were distracted. I believed that this would be my last chance. I took hold of Miss J to prevent the soldiers firing and attempted to escape in the Land Rover.
Thank you, Mr. Minister. Mr. Joseph Petal turned to the judge. My lord, my witness has had a tiring examination. May I suggest that the court rise until tomorrow morning to allow him a chance to recover? Abel Corrie was instantly up on his feet, lusting for blood.
It is barely noon yet, and the accused has been on the stand for less than 30 minutes, and his counsel has dealt with him recte et suaviter. For a trained and hardened soldier, that is a mere bagatelle per se.
Abel Corrie, in his agitation, lapsed into Latin. We will continue, Mr. Petal, said the judge, and Joseph Petal shrugged. Your witness, Mr. Corrie. Abel Corrie was in his element, becoming lyrical and poetic.
You testified that you were in fear of your life, but I put it to you that you were attacked by guilt, that you were in deadly fear of retribution, that you were terrified by the prospect of facing the exemplary processes of this very people's court, of facing the wrath of that learned and just scarlet-clad figure you now see before you.
No.
That it was nothing more than craven guilty conscience that made you embark on a series of heinous and callous criminal actions.
No, that is not so.
When you seized the lovely Miss J, did you not use excessive physical force to twist her young and tender limbs? Did you not rain brutal blows upon her?
I struck her once to prevent her hurling herself from the speeding vehicle and injuring herself seriously.
Did you not aim a deadly weapon, to wit, a military assault rifle, which you knew to be loaded, at the person of General Peter Fungabera?
I threatened him with the rifle, yes, that is true.
And then you fired deliberately at his nether regions, to wit, his abdomen.
I did not fire at Fungabera, I aimed to miss him.
I put it to you that you tried to murder the general, and only his marvellous reflexes saved him from your attack.
If I had tried to kill him, said Tungata softly, he would be dead.
When you stole the Land Rover, did you realize that it was state property? Did you aim the rifle at Mr. Craig Mello? And were you only prevented from murdering him by Miss J's brave intervention?
For almost another hour, Abel Corrie flew at the impassive figure in the dock, extracting from him a series of damning admissions, so that when at last Abel Corrie sat down, preening like a victorious gamecock, Craig judged that Mr. Joseph Petal had paid in heavy coin for any small advantage he might have gained by placing his client on the witness stand. However, Mr. Petal's closing address was finally pitched to incite sympathy and to explain and justify Tungata Zabiwe's actions on that night, without flouting the judge's patriotic or tribal instincts in the process.
I will reserve my judgment until tomorrow, Mr. Justice Domashawa announced,
and the court rose. the spectators humming with excited comment as they streamed out into the passage. Over dinner, Sally Ann admitted, "For the first time in this whole business, I felt sorry when Sarah went on the stand. She is such a sweet child."
"Child? I guess she's a year or two older than you," Craig chuckled. "That makes you a babe in arms."
She ignored his levity and went on seriously. "She so obviously believes in him that for a moment or two even I began to doubt what I knew. Then, of course, Abel Corrie brought me back to earth." Mr. Justice Domoshawa read out his judgment in his precise, old maidenish voice that somehow did not suit the gravity of the subject. Firstly, he covered the events that were common cause between prosecution and defence. And then he went on. "The defence has based its case on two main pillars. The first of these is the testimony of Miss Sarah Nyoni that the accused was on his way to what, for want of a better word, we are led to believe was a love tryst, and that his meeting with the truck was a coincidence or contrived in some unexplained manner by persons unknown. Now, Miss Nyoni impressed this court as being a naive and unworldly young lady, and by her admission is completely under the influence of the accused. The court has had, perforce, to consider the prosecution's postulation that Miss Nyoni might even have been, in fact, so influenced by the accused as to consent to act as an accomplice in arranging the consignment of contraband. In view of the foregoing, the court has rejected the testimony of Miss Nyoni as potentially biased and unreliable. The second pillar of the defence case rests on the premise that the life of the accused was threatened, or that he believed it to be threatened by the arresting officers, and in this belief embarked on a series of unreasoned and unreasoning acts of self-protection. General Peter Funke-Bearer is an officer of impeccable reputation, a high official of the state. The 3rd Brigade is an elite unit of the state's regular army. Its members, although battle-hardened veterans, are disciplined and trained soldiers. The court therefore categorically rejects the accused's contention that either General Funke-Bearer or his men could have, even in the remotest possibility, constituted a threat to his safety, let alone his life. The court also rejects the contention that the accused believed this to be the case. Accordingly, I come to the first charge, namely, that of trading or dealing in the products of scheduled wild animals. I find the accused guilty as charged, and I sentence him to the maximum penalty under the law, 12 years at hard labour. On the second charge of abducting and holding a hostage, I find the accused guilty as charged, and I sentence him to 10 years at hard labour. On the third charge of assault with a deadly weapon, I find the accused guilty and sentence him to 6 years at hard labour. Assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm, 6 years at hard labour. Attempted murder, 6 years at hard labour. I order that these sentences run consecutively and that no part of them be suspended. Even Abel Corrie's head jerked up at that. The sentences totaled 40 years. With full remission for good behaviour, Tungata could still expect to serve over 30 years, the rest of his useful life. At the back of the court, a black woman shrieked in Sindhubele, "Baba, the father! They are taking our father from us!" Others took up the cry. "Father of the people, our father is dead to us!" A man began to sing in a soaring baritone voice. "Why do you weep, widows of Shangani? Why do you weep, little sons of the moles, when your fathers did the king's bidding?" It was one of the ancient fighting songs of the impis of King Lobengula, and the singer was a man in his prime with a strong, intelligent face and a short-cropped, spade-shaped beard, barely speckled with grey. As he sang, the tears ran down his cheeks into his beard. In another time, he might have been an induna of one of the royal impis. His song was taken up by the men around him, and Mr. Justice Domoshawa came to his feet in a fury.
"If there is not silence this instant, I will have the court cleared and the offenders charged with contempt," he shouted over the singing.
but it was 5 minutes more of pandemonium before the ushers could restore order. Through it all, Tungata Zabiwe stood quietly in the dock, with just the barest hint of a mocking smile on his lips. When at last it was over, but before his guards led him away, he gazed across the courtroom at Craig Mellor, and he made a last hand signal. They had only used it playfully before, perhaps after a hard-contested bout of wrestling or some other friendly competition. Now Tungata used it in deadly earnest. The sign meant, "We are equal. The score is levelled." And Craig understood completely. Craig had lost his leg, and Tungata had lost his freedom. They were equal. He wanted to call out to the man who had once been his friend that it was a sorry bargain, not of his choosing. But Tungata had turned away. His warders were trying to lead him out of the dock. But Tungata pulled back, his head turning as he searched for someone else in the crowded court. Sarah Nyoni climbed up onto her bench, and over the heads of the crowd she reached out both hands towards him. Now Tungata made his last hand signal to her. Craig read it clearly. "Take cover," Tungata ordered her. "Hide yourself. You are in danger." By the altered expression on her face, Craig saw that the girl had understood the command, and then the warders were dragging Tungata Zabiwe down the stairs that led to the prison cells below ground. Craig shoved his way through the singing, lamenting crowds of Matabele who overflowed the buildings of the Supreme Court and disrupted the lunch-hour traffic in the broad causeway that it fronted. He dragged Sally Ann by her wrist and brusquely shouldered aside the press photographers who tried to block his way. In the car park, he boosted Sally Ann into the front seat of the Land Rover and ran around to the driver's side, threatening with a raised fist the last and most persistent photographer in his path. He drove directly to her apartment and halted at the front door. He did not turn off the engine. "And now?" Sally Ann asked. "I don't understand the question," he snapped.
"Hey," she said, "I'm your friend. Remember me?"
"I'm sorry." He slumped over the wheel. I just feel rotten, plain bloody rotten." She did not reply, but her eyes were full of compassion for him.
40 years. He whispered.
"I never expected that. If only I'd known." "There was nothing you could do then or now." He balled his fist and hammered it on the steering wheel. "The poor bastard. 40 years. "Are you coming up?" she asked softly, but he shook his head. "I have to get back to King's Lynn. I've neglected everything while this awful bloody business has been going on."
"You're going right now?" She was startled.
"Yes."
"Alone?"
she asked, and he nodded. "I want to be alone."
"So you can torture yourself?" Her voice firmed. "And I'll be damned if I'll allow that. I'm coming with you. Wait. I'm going to throw some things in a bag. You needn't even kill the engine. I'll be that quick."
She was 5 minutes, and then ran back down the stairs, lugging her rucksack and her camera bag. She slung them into the back of the Land Rover. "Okay, let's go." They spoke very little on the long journey, but soon Craig was thankful to have her beside him, grateful for her smile when he glanced at her, for the touch of her hand on his when she sensed the black mood too strong upon him, and for her undemanding silence. They drove up the hills of King's Lynn in the dusk. Joseph had seen them from afar and was waiting on the front veranda.
"I see you in Kozazana."
From their first meeting, Joseph had taken an instant liking to Sally Ann. Already she was his little mistress, and his welcoming grin kept breaking through his solemn dignity as he ordered his servants to unload her meagre luggage.
"I run bath for you. Very hot."
"That'll be marvellous, Joseph." After her bath, she came back to the veranda, and Craig went to the drinks table and mixed a whisky for her, the way she liked it, and another one for himself that was mainly scotch and very little soda. "Here's to Judge Domishawa," he lifted his glass ironically, "and to Mashona Justice, all 40 years of it." Sally Ann refused wine at dinner, despite his protest.
Baron Rothschild would be frightfully affronted. It's his very best stuff. My last bottle, smuggled in personally. Craig's gaiety was forced. After dinner, he lifted the brandy decanter, and as he was about to pour, she said, "Craig, please don't get drunk." He paused with the decanter over the snifter and studied her face. "No," she shook her head, "I'm not being bossy. I'm being entirely selfish. Tonight I want you to be sober." He set down the decanter, pushed back his chair, and came around the table to her. She stood up to meet him. He paused in front of her. "Oh, my darling, I've waited so long." "I know," she whispered. "Me too." He took her carefully into his arms, something precious and fragile, and felt her changing slowly. She seemed to soften, and her body became malleable, shaping itself to his own, so he could feel her against him. From knees to firm young bosom, the heat of her soaking quickly through their thin clothing. He bowed his head as she lifted her chin, and their mouths came together. Her lips were cool and dry, but almost immediately he felt the heat rising in them, and they parted, moist and sweet, as a sun-warmed fig freshly plucked and splitting open with its ripe juices. He looked into her eyes as he kissed her, and marvelled at the colours and the patterns that formed a nimbus around her pupils, green shot through with golden arrowheads. And then her eyelids fluttered down over them, and her long, crisp lashes interlocked. He closed his own eyes, and the earth seemed to tilt and swing under him. He rode it easily, holding her to him, but not trying yet to explore her body, content with the wonder of her mouth and the velvet feel of her tongue against his. Joseph opened the door from the kitchen and stood for a moment with the coffee tray in his hands, and then he smiled smugly and drew back, closing the door behind him. Neither of them had heard him come or go. When she took her mouth away, Craig felt deprived and cheated, and reached for it again. She laid her fingers across his lips, restraining him for a moment, and her whisper was so husky that she had to clear her throat and start again.
Let's go to your bedroom, darling," she said.
There was one awkward moment when he sat naked on the edge of the bed to remove his leg. But she knelt quickly in front of him, naked also, pushing his hands away and undid the straps herself. Then she bowed her head and kissed the neat, hard pad of flesh at the extremity of his leg.
"Thank you," he said. "I'm glad you could do that."
"It's you," she said. "And part of you," and she kissed it again, and then ran her lips gently up to his knee and beyond.